Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to the latest episode of New Books in Intellectual History. I'm your host, Thomas Kingston. My guest today is Lorenzo Veracini, Associate Professor in History and Politics at Swinburne University of Technology, Melbourne. He is the founding editor of Settler Colonial Studies and was the co-editor of the Routledge Handbook of the History of Settler Colonial Studies. Today, we're going to be speaking about his new book, The World Turned Inside Out, Settler Colonialism as a Political Idea, published by Verso Books. Lorenzo, thank you for joining us today.
It's fabulous being here.
To begin with, could you give us a brief overview of what settler colonialism is? I think it's a phrase that will be familiar to many listeners, but from reading the book, I got the impression that it's not just a sum of its part. It isn't just settlers colonizing things. There's something more to it.
Settler colonialism is a mode of domination. It's distinct from other types of colonialism. It's distinct from other types of empire. Its study has recently been the subject of a number of publications and scholarly works. One of the things that it's important about settler colonialism is that it's ongoing, that the settler societies are still settler colonizing. And the relationship between settlers and indigenous peoples in these countries is still a relationship that is mediated by settler colonialism.
I think that's a very good way of putting it. And I think that's one of the a really good example here is that, as I said, many listeners will be familiar with the notion of settling and familiar with the imperial and, shall we say, economic aspects of colonialism as an empire. But what your book really seems to set out to do, and I really enjoyed it, was it explores it, as the name suggests, the history of it as an idea. And I think that's quite interesting. So could you talk a little bit about, shall we say, the genesis of this idea? Where does it come from?
The book has been a long time coming. I've been thinking about its major themes for quite some time, for a couple of decades. We know how settler colonialism works. We know what settlers do, but we're not really acquainted with what they think they are doing when they do the things they do. I'm interested in focusing on the political imagination that shapes their actions, on the way they understand the political orders they intend to build. So I wanted to focus on the imagination, on the imaginaries, on the fantasies that drive settler colonialism, drive the fantasies of picking up stumps and going somewhere else and setting up a new political order. I wanted to know what settlers think when they imagine themselves building societies, building political orders, building polities.
And I think that comes across very clearly in the book. And there are a number of themes going on. And once again, returning to the title, there is this recurring presence of this notion of the world turned inside out. And I mean, that it's a very powerful phrasing, and I think obviously that's intentional. How does settler colonialism link to this notion of the world turned inside out?
Look, it's a reference to Christopher Hill's famous book, The World Turned Upside Down. The idea that revolution can upend established orders, established relationships, is responded to by the people I study, by their imaginings, with a displacement. Rather than focusing on a particular geography and contesting it, the power as is structured in a particular place, the people I've studied repeatedly think about moving on, about moving somewhere else, about starting anew. So they respond to contradictions with a determination to relocate somewhere else, of diffusing contradictions by displacing instead. And so the word turned inside out as an expression sort of conveys the notion that we are talking about horizontal relationships rather than vertical relationships that are rather conveyed by the expression of the world turned upside down.
Yeah, I think that this notion of the contradictions is another very intriguing thing. And I think in the what I found very interesting was it explored how these contradictions and their displacements, the motives behind the displacement of these came from a variety of sources. Some of it was grassroots, and it was from the settlers themselves, and other times it was sort of from the elites who had their own motives. I think one of the key things I noticed was that was this notion of deferral, and I wondered if you could talk about that. What sort of deferral was hoped to be achieved by this displacement? Like what sort of conditions were we hoping, or contradictions were hoped to be deferred?
So the sources I've studied, I could have included many more in the book, but I needed to be selective. The sources I've studied included two types of sensibilities. There were those who were embracing change, but they also felt that change was not coming. And so they needed to displace so that they could enjoy change in their own lives, in their own experiences. So these people were appreciative of the possibilities of revolution and change, but they were skeptical about the chances that revolution would come, right? They understood that the revolutionary project was doomed or defeated, and so they responded to defeat by imagining displacements elsewhere. And there were those who had a rather conservative disposition, and they saw revolution coming. They thought that the odds were on the side of revolution, and therefore they responded to these rising contradictions by imagining displacements as a way of preempting contradictions, of setting up regenerated places elsewhere in order to offset whatever damage, in their own opinion, revolution may do. So both a revolutionary sensitivity and a conservative sensitivity converge on the idea of displacing in order to resolve contradictions. And this is very important because even though these sensitivities were separate, were distinct, on the ground, when they got to the new places, they mixed and they interacted and they collaborated. And so oftentimes in my book, I speak about people that would fight to the end in the old country against each other and collaborated to the end in the new country in order to build a new political order.
I think that was another sort of theme I noticed, especially in the North American example, was how the revolutionary element was sometimes seemed to be sought, seemed that that the, shall we say, the conservatives sought to harness it as a tool or control it in a way, which obviously led to further tension. I mean, the key example, and probably one that many people are familiar with in terms of when it comes to settler colonialism, is the westward expansion of the United States. And this is something that you deal with and explore through a range of things, including masculinity and religious aspects. So I was wondering as well, in that angle, that then leads to a contradiction, which is something you mentioned, that there's this dialectical relationship even between these two ideas. And we talk about, as we said earlier, that we said about, that it's a historic thing, it's ongoing. How do we see these this tension playing out in the present in terms of character in a country like the United States?
Look, I've discovered what I claim to be an autonomous political tradition, an autonomous political tradition that thinks about displacement rather than change that is in place. And I have observed it in its development through the last 500 years. But the purpose of this study was to actually observe this political tradition in its current operation. And so perhaps I could refer to an obvious example of the world turning inside out that I couldn't include in the book because the final manuscript was handed in earlier this year, and ideas about a new metropolis to be built in the United States with funding arising from different sources under the leadership of billionaire Mark Lohr, who made a fortune with Walmart, only came out recently. So this is the story. There is a plan to build this city called Tolosa. Tolosa will be a new metropolis. It will host up to 5 million people, and it will be built from scratch in a location that hasn't yet been selected. The organizers of this new colony are a new city, a new colony, are scouting the United States. This city will be built with sustainable urban design in mind. Will be a city where residents have a stake in the whole of the city, not just in their own little parcel of real estate. It's a city that will be built according to principles that refer directly back to what Henry George, the economist of the late 19th century, the United States economist of the late 19th century, had in mind. So there will be a land tax, resources will be nationalized, will be centrally owned, and so on and so forth. And if you look at the prospectus, if you look at the information that is provided in the official internet site of Tolosa, the new city, you see that the reason why this is this project is being proposed is that its billionaire advocate is seeing contradictions rising. He's seeing that there is rising inequality, and this creates a genuine revolutionary contradiction. He also sees a climate change happening, and he sees the contradictions that this will arise. You know, he's mentioning that billions of people will be directly affected by climate change, and the response is not to change things in place to endeavor to mitigate climate change emissions and so on and so forth. The response is to move somewhere else. It doesn't matter where, because Tolosa is just an idea, hasn't yet landed anywhere, and it will probably remain an idea. But it is important that we understand that these ideas have a long, long, long history. And this is not just utopian thinking. This is not about building a new place so that its practice can engage with change where we are. This idea is about building a new place elsewhere so that we can escape the contradiction we are facing with our facing that. So the idea is that that this tradition is alive and kicking, that the apocalyptic imagination that it thrived on through the centuries is alive and kicking, and that the prospect of moving on rather than changing things is still very much a present concern.
Obviously, you've said that a lot of the focus of this is on the imagination, and I think that that shines through when we talk about the different kinds of displacement, how I suppose, like many, I imagined that settler colonialism involved packing your bags, getting on a ship, and going to, shall we say, like quote-unquote new land, and doing that. But a number of examples in the book don't, in fact, involve that at all, and sometimes don't involve going very far at all. Would you like to talk a little bit more about that?
Yes, I've discovered that that the political disposition that I was exploring was at times very interested in the specific location that they were projecting. So the Puritans that went to Massachusetts really thought that that was a specific locale endowed with a particular charge, and no other place could work. And similarly, the Zionists that went to Palestine also thought that only Palestine would do for their own political project, that no other location would have been appropriate. But I also found out that the people that were seeking to change things by displacing elsewhere didn't really think much about where specifically they should go. That locales could actually be all over the place or very, very close to home, but they had to be new places. So Owen, for example, built colonies on the other side of the ocean, but also built villages not far from where his factories were located. But they had to be new places. They had to be places that were they were away from the site of contradiction. So in the tradition that I have explored, what really mattered was to move on from the site of contradiction, no matter where. It could have been even to the next suburb. In fact, suburbs in suburbia are indeed part of the political tradition I was exploring. And so one can reconfigure geography. One could build up barriers that actually displace without removing actually from one location to another. You can manipulate space as well as move across space. That's one of the things I've discovered while exploring this political tradition.
And I think what was then interesting as well was that there is sort of a reverse engineering. There's a justification if it isn't that far, right? Because, I mean, for example, we have the one of the examples you give is, I believe, Finnish settlers that moved to North America, and then they sort of construct this sort of fraternal ties or some sort of myth about kinship with the locals. And that's another recurring thing, is that the indigenous people, they play a role in the creation of this myth, but they're never actually really treated as people, which I suppose is the underlying point of the settler colonial thing. I mean, and the other example we have is the Mormons, who create this notion that the Native Americans, the indigenous people of North America, are descended from the tribes of Israel, and therefore it's fulfilling a sort of biblical prophecy. Yet these people don't feature very much actually later on in the actual project, right?
That's right. Look, settler colonialists always displace indigenous people. It's what their business is about. And there is by now a significant body of literature that has explored this statement of fact, this unavoidable fact of settler colonialism. And indigenous studies as an intellectual endeavor has now addressed what was for a long time a settler colonial cult of forgetfulness about indigenous people, and this is an accomplished feature of the current intellectual landscape. But when it comes to the imagination of settler colonialism, so the actual topic that I was dealing with and the sources that I was addressing, I have to say that settlers do not think much about indigenous people. They don't like to think about it. They only think about indigenous people in as much as they can be used to further the settlers' claims to indigeneity. So the settlers want the indigenous lands, but they also want the way indigenous people enjoy the indigenous land. So the settlers want the land and they want to enjoy it as indigenous peoples would, right? So in this sense, the settlers do think about indigenous people and how they relate to the land. But the settlers that I was dealing with were more interested in setting up new political orders from scratch and in disregarding the presence and activity of indigenous people. When they did consider indigenous peoples and their demand and their insurgencies, it was because they were useful for triangulating their own particular settler colonial project within a wider settler colonial project. So, for example, the Finnish settlers that you kindly refer to and that I do address in my book were in the business of establishing their own particular sovereignty. So they were contesting the presence of indigenous people on the one hand and the encroaching presence of the Canadian state on the other. And so this triangular system of relations saw the local settlers relating to indigenous people and supporting their demands for the purpose of undermining that of the Canadian state. So in that particular context, there was an engagement with indigenous people. But overall, the political tradition I do appraise in this book rarely concedes of indigenous people or is concerned with them.
And possibly in a complete opposite to what we talked about just a couple of questions ago, just as there is this internal colonization that exists within, shall we say, national or continental borders and doesn't involve traveling that far, the imaginary element means that, no pun intended, the sky isn't even the limit, right? I mean, and that's one of the incarnations we're seeing now.
Look, the sky is not the limit. We mentioned earlier that this political tradition is not particularly concerned on where specifically you have to build a new political order. And so what we see today is that several billionaires are in the business of imagining the possibilities of relocating elsewhere, I mean, outside of this planet. They see this planet as ridden with contradiction, and they are not interested in investing in fixing the problems of this planet. They are rather proposing that we move somewhere else. So we have basically two templates here for space colonies here. We have the Bezos template. He's thinking about orbiting big, big, big cylinders that rotate, and so they have a gravitational system inside. And he thinks that wealthy people could move there and abandon the rest to the disasters that are coming. He's also thinking, he's on record thinking that perhaps these orbiting station would exceed the fiscal zones of the various states that still dwell on Earth. So this relocation will actually have a fiscal dimension as far as he's concerned, and that would make it very, very interesting for the people that could be persuaded to move there. And then we have the other model. Is the Elon Musk's model, and he He's thinking about Mars. And he knows that there will be serious problems about setting up a working colony in Mars. So, for example, without really thinking much about it, he has proposed that indenture be revived and reestablished in order to provide the wealthy settlers that would relocate there with the necessary labor that they would require. So we see that that there is an ongoing connection between the long history of settler colonialism and its political imagination and the current practice of settler colonialism and its political imagination.
Yeah, and hopefully not spoiling the book, but at the end of it, you get to the point that it's an almost impossible situation, right? There is no resolution to the contradictions that they are seeking to escape from.
Yes, indeed. I have looked at this political tradition. I've explored its long-term evolution, its development, its various the various solutions that have been prospected, and I've explored its practice, and I've explored its political theory. And I've remained unconvinced. I don't think that that escaping sideways, I don't think that flight is a durable solution to emerging contradictions. What happens all the time is that contradictions catch up, that what one is escaping from is only temporarily escaped, and the contradictions catch up, and very, very fast, much faster than the advocates of the political tradition I've explored envisage. And so I conclude my book on a skeptical note. I think that the political traditions of settler colonialism have failed in their attempt to resolve contradictions by moving sideways.
Yeah, and I think that's a really interesting point, because as well, also throughout the book we see this theme of how actually not only the escape but the process of escaping and the sort of acclimatization to the displaced zone. I mean, we see examples of people talking about how the colonists are stronger and they're superior to those back at home, and in a way, it leads me to think, going on your conclusion, that some of this is almost attempting to convince themselves that this is the case, just as much as it is a statement or factor of observation. Would you agree?
I do agree. And the political traditions that I explore are replete with exemplars of regenerated manhood, of regenerated community, of a regenerated life that is truly authentic to itself, precisely because it has moved away from its origins. But it doesn't work. It doesn't work in the long run. These depictions are spurious always, but when looked from afar, when looked with the benefit of hindsight, they are patently false. They are patently an expression of wishful thinking rather than an ability to generate a positive change. Look, The three political traditions of modernity, revolution, reaction, and the world turned inside out, as I have defined it, have all sort of reached their limit and had to contend with their failures. And it's important that at this point in time, when we are facing a massive crisis. We are facing massive contradictions, and the prospect of moving on yet again somewhere else, possibly to a metaverse, we should be wary of the prospect of settling somewhere else yet again, of moving one last time and in order to move no more. This is a fantasy and should be considered as such. And in my book, I do consider it as such.
Yeah, and I think that's a really nice way to end things, because it really does emphasize how, as I said, it reads as a historical account, but by the end of it, the relevance is, it's hard to miss. And it definitely causes a lot of self-reflection for me and in my field of studies. So one last question before we go. Where do you see the field that you are the pioneer of, settler colonial studies, where do you see this going in the next few years?
That's actually a question I've been pondering. On the one hand, I am pleased to report that many of the very reasons that prompted the consolidation of this intellectual endeavor have been met. We now know about settler colonialism. We now know about how it works. We now know how it is inevitably destructive of indigenous sovereignties and life. We now know that the attempts to erase indigeneity are part of a logic of elimination that is relentlessly pursued and yet is also resisted with efficacy by indigenous agents and so on and so forth. So on the one hand, its mission is in a sense complete. Indigenous people were embracing settler colonial studies in its infancy because it was offering intellectual tools that they understood were very, very useful for their own struggles. But now settler colonial studies, it's almost a given. We know that many of the countries of the world today are settler societies, and they are the result of historical processes of settlement, and they have unresolved issues of sovereignty arrangements with their indigenous peoples. So the future of settler colonial studies, in a way, it's irrelevant. It's done what it was meaning to do. It was able to say that settler colonialism is an ongoing structure, is not relegated to the past. Some of the most important insights of settler colonial studies have been made and have been accepted. Are part of an ongoing public discussion that has exceeded the boundaries of academia. So I am, in a way, happy to say that perhaps settler colonial studies doesn't have a future as an independent field of studies, because it did what it was it set out to do in the first place.
Okay, well, it's rare to hear someone welcoming the end of their field, but it's a really insightful way of putting it. So I just want to thank you for joining me today. And I'm sure the listeners have really enjoyed it. And as I say, the world turned inside out. Settler colonialism is a political idea. It's published by Verso Books. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. Thank you.